Coming up on Digital Music Trends 174, recorded live at South by Southwest 2014, Spotify acquires the Echo Nest, Neil Young launches the Pono as a Kickstarter, and Samsung launches Milk. Plus, at the end of the show, the interviews are recorded with Sachin Doshi from Spotify and Kevin Arnold, founder of Open Aura. This week's show is brought to you by Omniphone, the leading B2B cloud music provider powering global music services including Sony Music Unlimited, Guvera, Rara, and Sirius XM. Find out more on omniphone.com. And by MusicGraph, the world's first knowledge engine for music, available as a consumer app and as a graph API for developers. Check out musicgraph.com or developer.musicgraph.com. Hello everyone, and welcome to Digital Music Trends, a weekly show where we talk about and try to make sense of the latest news in the digital music industry. And today it's a bit of a special show. We're recording live from South by Southwest here in Austin, Texas. And it's a real pleasure to welcome Jim Carroll from the Irish Times. So hi, Jim. How's it going?
Very good, Andrea. Good to see you as well.
And Brian Zisk from SF Music Tech. How's it going, Jim? Brian?
It's going great, and it's especially nice to meet you in person after all these videos.
I know, that's true. And Kevin Browner from CD Baby. So hi, Kevin. Thanks for joining me. How's it going?
How's it going?
All good.
So feel free to grab the mic. We have two mics here, so we're going to try and work with that. And, you know, today we're going to just look at the headlines. We only have about a half hour to record the show, so we're going to try and get through all the main news of the day. And at the end of the show, I'm going to add a couple of the interviews I recorded in the last few days. I've got Spotify. I've got a new company called Open Aura, created by the founder of IOTA. So that should be a pretty good show. But the headlines are actually plentiful this week. So first of all, we're going to talk about the Echo Nest. So the Echo Nest has been acquired by Spotify. It was announced just a few days ago, and it's caused quite a few ripples here at South by Southwest. A lot of interest in the company. I know that Paul Amir's panel yesterday was packed. I couldn't even get in. I was 5 minutes late. So great stuff over there. So that comes close on the heels of Spotify's acquisition of we're going to get sound checks now, but it's fine. The mics are really directional, so it's not a real problem. It comes close on the heels of the acquisition by Beats of Topspin.
Yes.
And so, you know, two big acquisitions coming one after the other. The Echo Nest said that their API is going to remain open for the foreseeable future. And but we're starting to see some ripples in the industry, as, for example, the CEO of RDO last night announced that they wouldn't stay with the Echo Nest, and they would move on and find another service provider. So, you know, what are your impressions of this acquisition, first of all, and what do you think the consequences are for the industry as a whole?
Well, I mean, if you've been keeping an eye on Echo Nest, I suppose, over the last couple of years, they've been a very innovative company. What they've been doing is really interesting. The purchase by Spotify, it's like, you know, it's monopoly money in a way. I mean, it's also kind of like, I suppose, FU money as well. You know, I mean, they know that what Echo Nest has got is really, really valuable, and everyone else is going to be after that for the foreseeable future. They also know as well that, like, I could be wrong here, but like, they also know as well that by taking control of Echo Nest, it means that an awful lot of competitors will basically stop using Echo Nest API. They will. Echo Nest may well claim the API is open, but like, everyone's kind of going, we're not going to work with our competitors. You know. Also, I think what we're seeing here as well is we're seeing, I suppose, the increasing, I suppose, microization of the streaming market. You know, like, I mean, it really is coming into a number of very big players, and that's it. We've talked about this many times on the show, Andrea, before, about the fact that, do we need all these different streaming services? Why are all these kind of Me Too streaming services popping up? Well, I mean, Spotify have this big war chest, so they're also going out, kind of, we're going buying the valuable stuff that's out there at the moment.
Yeah. Brian?
I'm very happy for my friends at Echo Nest. I hope Spotify has a great IPO and they all make lots of money. For the ecosystem, it is a very interesting situation. I mean, when you start building on other people's APIs, you really are a little bit at their mercy. I mean, we had that issue when we were using the Twitter API and the price would go up 100x and, you know, they couldn't tell us it wasn't going to go up 100x again. So, you know, Echo Nest has really facilitated the ecosystem, though. There are so many of these streaming systems that popped up as almost like a hack day project, and it was really interesting because you could build personalized radio, and with the whole Pandora IPO frenzy, everybody really wanted to be a part of it, and Echo Nest provided that part of the ecosystem. Now, of course, they're going to continue supporting people as long as the contracts run, but according to the Echo Nest FAQ, They're just thrilled about everything, and they will continue to love and support their partners.
I think you guys said it all. I don't have any further comments.
Kevin, on your front, what do you think is coming next? Can you imagine other data companies like Last.fm, for example, that has been with CBS for years, but they're not really doing much with it? Can you imagine them doing something and somebody actually being interested in acquiring them after this?
Yeah, I mean, when I saw the Echo Nest purchase, I thought it was more of like Spotify trying to have more of a discovery engine that trying to compete with what Beats is. Tried to make a big point about being able to discover music easier in their system, but I mean it's interesting that there's a lot of people like Last.fm. People still use it a lot, and it's a nice kind of aggregator of data that's still sitting out there. I'm sure someone will pick it up soon.
Yeah, exactly. And so the other thing that happened this week was Pono. So yesterday I saw Neil Young's keynote. It was kind of a keynote, kind of an interview. It was both. I think half of it was a speech and half of it was an interview. So he launched this project. To be honest, I've been a major doubter of Pono so far, but I was really interested in the fact that they launched the Kickstarter campaign, and it's already raised $1.3 million as of this morning on the 800 grand that it had as a minimum. So it's already gone past that, although 800 grand I don't think it would be enough to create a hardware device, but an interesting take here. I mean, Pono is going to support, it's both a hardware device and a platform where they're going to sell music from. It's going to support all sorts of bit rates from the lowest to the highest, 192 kilohertz I think, which is insane, but Neil Young said that he can hear the difference, and if a 60-year-old that has been playing loud music for forever can hear the difference, then I'm it's something. And they had a bunch of interviews from the likes of Bruce Springsteen, Elton John, Flea from Royal Chili Peppers.
Neil's mates.
Yeah, exactly. A bunch of people that all talked about how great it sounded and everything else. So I don't know. I can imagine there being a niche market here for people that want this, and there's 4,000 backers now. But 4,000 or 40,000 or 50,000 backers at the end of the campaign, are they enough to support an ecosystem based on high quality audio? Kevin, I don't know, you have experience in this field as well, so you want to take that?
Yeah, I'm very skeptical as well. You can hear the difference. I mean, I haven't heard their particular product, but when you're comparing like a WAV file to an MP3, there is a drastic difference in audio quality. Whether or not the average consumer cares, I would say they probably don't. I mean, more and more people are using streaming services, which sound even worse than an MP3. And so the industry is kind of going the opposite direction.
Yeah.
I mean, it's got to take massive adoption in order for it to them to be able to afford to keep making them and iterating. Otherwise, it's just going to be a mini disc player, which I still have one.
Oh, yeah, their mini disc players are still very, very good. They still work. I still have a cassette recorder. That still works as well. All these things still work, but it comes down to a mass audience. Will the mass audience go for it? I mean, you said there a very good, interesting thing. You said about the niche audience. There's definitely a niche audience out there of both Neil Young fans and heritage rock fans who will go with something like this. But is there enough of them to go for it? I don't know. I mean, you mentioned numbers like 4,000, 40,000. Maybe he's done some. Maybe he'll come up with a shortfall himself from his own bank account, But like, it's interesting. I spoke to someone who's even a bigger skeptic than probably the four of us put together yesterday, and he was at the showcase yesterday, and he was really curious afterwards. And this is someone like who was going in just to kind of like poo-poo the whole idea.
You're skeptic.
But he came out and he was kind of not converted, but very, very curious. And like, if there's people like that out there who kind of going like they want more than streaming, they want better quality than streaming, they want something else, and they're Neil Young fans, they're heritage rock fans, there could be an audience. I mean, there's a device back in the UK, I think it's called Bannon, that Bannon CD player, for example, that's got a market. There are markets out there, but it'll be niche, not mass.
Yeah.
Well, I'm a huge Neil Young fan, and I think I'm going to come down, I don't want to be contrarian, but slightly more optimistic than my esteemed colleagues here. So here's the story. There is a difference, and that's what I think the key point is that Neil wants there to be better quality music. I think he feels that, 14 songs 20 years ago, there's 14 songs now. It's not like the value of 14 songs now is that much greater. There's more competition, but people can, I don't need to be in the room with my disc and the player. I have it all on my phone or streaming anywhere. So I don't think it's that Neil is interested in really doing hardware, and I think that's what the Kickstarter sort of showed. It's not like, I'm going out there, I'm going to create a Sonos, I'm going to create a Beats by Dre. It's not one of those plays. I think it's very much that he really wants people to appreciate that the higher quality music, music files, is a higher quality experience, and if you want to make a change, you've got to go out there and do it yourself. So it's not like this is a misdirection, but I really kind of think those triangular shaped players, they'll be great collector's items. It'll be wonderful for people who want to support Neil directly. But what all of a sudden people are starting to say, oh, CDs, you know, there were a few people who'd say, oh, vinyl's better than CDs. But now I think people will really see that there are better formats and stronger formats. And my belief is he's going to come out with these. But the real aim is to build an ecosystem where you can have the higher quality files and have a more enjoyable music experience. I mean, and the one final thing there is, in case he pulls it off and people start doing what they did when they replaced their vinyl with CDs, if all of a sudden you can get people to buy the collection again in a higher res format, that would be great. That part I'm skeptical on, but in reality, I think it's a great move for him to really raise the profile of higher quality formats.
Yeah, I mean, it's just like a matter of figuring out whether it's sustainable as a service. Because if somebody's willing to drop $400 on a device, they might also be willing to drop, you know, $300-$400 a year on music. So maybe,
and
I don't know.
And I would add to the conversation, I'm all for it too. I want the higher quality as well, because that's one thing that annoys me and why I don't use. I use Spotify and Pandora a bit, but it's like the I want a better listening experience, and I'm willing to buy it if it's a good quality item. I just don't know if the average listener knows that that's a need, and that's why I think I don't know if it'll fly in the long run, but I hope it does.
And that's a hard part, because, you know, you're getting better and better quality with the streaming services all the time. And if I can get my entire family unlimited music on Beats, you know, for under $200 a year, it's going to be hard to convince us to buy 20 CDs. You know, especially if eventually these higher quality files make their ways onto all the streaming services, the days of buying, you know, physical product or downloads to go to tie to physical product may be over.
Yeah, I think as well, it's what you said as well about, like, you know, what that number is out there. I mean, if you look at younger music fans, do they care about the music quality? They care about if they're really into their music and they start making music themselves and they begin to appreciate the difference. But most of them have just got used to, like, I mean, like, crappy YouTube files. You know, they have. That's become the standard for them, sadly.
Yeah, absolutely. And so, you know, going from high quality audio to a totally different type of experience. So we've seen Samsung come out with yet another attempt to conquer the music market this week with Milk. We've seen a Milk van outside on I think it was Friday, and everybody went, oh, what is this? It's a new Samsung music service for the US, which is based essentially on Slacker. It does provide a different UI, and I've heard from a couple of people that it's actually quite an interesting UI, but it is essentially Slacker music. It is free to access, locked down to Samsung Galaxy owners on the Android App Store for now. So a very interesting play for Samsung here, and their maybe third or fourth attempt to get into the music market properly. So why do manufacturers keep trying to get into this game? And is it just like a Samsung versus Apple thing?
I believe it makes a lot of sense, because when you have a phone, is it a phone or is it a phone in a music device? And if you're going to be selling, you know, it's like people don't know. It's like, I don't want to get an iPhone. I'll get a Samsung. I'll get a this. I'll get a that. What comes with it? Oh, unlimited music? It's a real feature. And whereas it's hard to sell music these days, you know, it's very easy to use music to help sales of other products. So if you all of a sudden, if people choose to buy a Samsung device because of Milk, I mean, how much do the manufacturers make per phone? It's like a couple hundred per phone, and then they share in the contract, and you're talking about a $4,000 or $5,000 commitment over a few years. That's a family plan, unlimited data. I get that. You know, if it helps sell some more of those, it's really worthwhile. And that's something that's important, is how do you take the visceral response to music that people have and have it help drive much larger transactions. If you sell, you know, a $1 song or a $15 a month subscription, it's one thing. If you help, if it helps you sell a $60,000 Lexus, that really helps send more value to the creators of music and in various ways of compensation.
And we've seen actually the iTunes Radio yesterday. I've seen a survey saying that it's become the third biggest streaming service.
I saw that too. But what does that mean? Is like, does that mean people accidentally click on iTunes Radio as they're scrolling through it? I don't know what to number. You know.
Yeah. Jim, what's
You see, it's like, is it that's I think that size says it all. I mean, no, like, you know, you could probably write a great book right now, Andrea, about all these different plays over the years and how successful, not successful they've been. What it comes down to, like, I mean, is it's mass market, it's little market. Mass market is kind of like it's YouTube, Spotify, Beats. Little market is everything else. Samsung, you're right, you're totally right there about why Samsung would get involved in something like this. But you said a very interesting thing. You kind of said about like what music driving kind of like the sale of a $60,000 Lexus, for example. I'm kind of going like, okay, that's a huge kind of sum of money kind of going to the garage owner and going to Lexus. Where is that money trickling down to the music maker then as well? I mean, and this is a very odd thing for me to be kind of saying, because normally I'm kind of arguing the other way around. But I often kind of wonder with all these plays that are going on, is it really bringing more value to music? Is it really bringing more profile to music? Or is it really just taking all that kind of oxygen away and giving it solely to the device maker, in this case Samsung?
I mean, my thought is that it actually, with the Cricket wireless system and their Move Music, they actually did get some pretty good traction from that. And you know, we saw some decent payments going to artists that they're getting their music on there. But it is a play for the manufacturer. I mean, they're trying to sell devices. I mean, that's what Apple's trying to do with the iTunes Store, is sell devices. So. Whether or not it'll stick, I don't know. But I know Samsung is desperately trying to take down the iPhone, and they've been making some good strides. So.
And are you surprised to see Slacker being part of the play in this case?
Well, I mean, Slacker's a good product, so it's not surprising at all, actually. Yeah. I mean, what's really interesting with things like you know, Move and iTunes, there were all these huge music markets that popped up because the music industry felt that they were really insignificant markets. You know, Apple has a 5% market share. Oh, sure, we'll give them, let them try this. It can't really mess with our market, you know, or Move, which is really towards the low-income consumer who never really spends money on music. So the incremental revenue there is really valuable, and it's really informative that it turns out to be these initially fringe systems that kind of are allowed to sneak through because they're not going to disrupt everything, that really end up driving so much stuff. And my final comment on that is that it will be really interesting when AT&T ditches Move and switches over their 2 million customers over to Beats. I have no inside information. I know nothing, but can't wait to see it happen.
That's interesting. And, you know, we also saw that Beats apparently raised $60 million last night. I haven't really read in depth the articles because I was half asleep when I saw the news. So I'm not really sure exactly what the details are on that and if there are any details. But again, another big fundraise for Beats that had already raised quite a bit of money last year. So, yeah, we're going to, you know, they must have spent a lot of the Super Bowl, right?
Well, I mean, how do you feel about Beats? I think Beats is my favorite service now. I mean, I apologize to my friends at Spotify and all that. But as of now, I think Beats is great. I don't know what else to say. I mean, it's got a long
UK
way to come, but it's really to launch with something that is better than the best is a really good start. And they're almost sucking the air out of the technical and employee market in the music tech space. Every time I turn around, it's like, this great friend is leaving from Apple over there. This great friend is leaving. You know, they're really hiring. And with this extra money, you know, they're going to be like the Google of the space. It's going to be very hard to compete with them for talent.
Yeah, but the other thing is, so at the same time, Beats has still got quite a road ahead when it comes to platform integration. Like, Spotify now appears to be the platform of choice when it comes to developers integrating that in their own apps.
But I believe today Beats is actually launching their API.
Exactly.
Literally today, as is OpenAura.
Yeah, so we're going to have to see what happens in that space. You know, do you think Beats needs to raise more money? Or
I have not used it personally. I've used it on other people's phones, just checking it out. My thing with them is I'm just curious, since they don't have a free option that you can try it free for 7 days, if that's going to inhibit massive growth. I mean, they've got a big buzz right now, and clearly they're spending some money and have a cool look and great campaign, which I knew they would, being tied to the Beats brand. But so I'm just curious to see how where they're at in 6 months and a year.
Yeah, absolutely. Jim, do you want to see that? Do you want to see Beats in Ireland?
Absolutely. But just want to try it out. But like you see, it's really curious to, as you started off by saying that they raised 60 million last night. I mean, are they burning through this money really, really fast? Is it all been spent on hires? What else has been spent on? You know, I mean, it's interesting that they're coming in at that kind of level, as with Spotify when they launch as well. The amount of money involved is ginormous. You know.
Well, I mean, they're really smart, and they know their numbers, and we don't. And the fact that so many people like me, you know, my whole family's on the 3-month free AT&T plan, and then the question is who's going to cancel it and who's not. And we're going to keep paying. And it's interesting because by being on AT&T, I believe when the 3 months end, you just automatically get billed to your account. It's not like one of those 3 months free and then put in your credit card. It's like if you don't cancel it, it's there. So my belief is a lot of these folks are going to convert. And I honestly, it's very interesting because everybody I know, except for me, says that the free model where you let people have stuff for free and then you upsell them, you know, well, it's bad that Beats doesn't do it. But in reality, that model hasn't been working so well.
Yeah.
And since you end up having, you know, I don't know what it is, 90%+ of the people not paying, could be 97%, I don't know, you have the pay people subsidizing the free people.
Yeah.
And in the Beats situation, especially since they get the consumer marketing and how to bring people in, I don't think the lack of a freemium of a free product will hurt them at all. Except among people who don't want to spend any money, who will just take for free everywhere.
Well, I mean, that was a good point because, the one thing that they've said is that they're going to be, payout artists better and more uniform across the board, not make secret backroom deals with the major labels than screw the other folks.
Yeah.
Which, I'm happy to see, and I hope they stay true to that. And you're right, when they don't have to subsidize a bunch of freebies, carry a bunch of dead weight, they're probably more able to do that.
And Jim, I wanted to finish by asking you about this acquisition that happened last week. Balcony TV was acquired by The Orchard. So Balcony TV was acquired by The Orchard.
Who was acquired by The Orchard?
Balcony TV.
Yeah, that was a Dublin-based startup who basically took balconies here in someone's apartment and basically did shows on them, and it spread from city to city. Very, very clever product. Fair play to the team. It has been a very, very good play. They went through an accelerator program in Dublin. They have expanded quite a lot. I mean, it's a very clever idea. I love these clever ideas that have come along in the media space over the last while. I mean, be it having concerts on a bandstand in London, concerts on the back of a black cab. These kind of ideas are just it's kind of clever, innovative use of video as well, that's getting away from very, very hackneyed ideas, as well for the bands as well involved. It's much, much better for them to actually go to someone's apartment and play in a balcony than do something normally. Very, very clever idea, but also kind of what makes you wonder as well, I suppose, we're now into the kind of Me Too factor. Who's next? What'll be the next Balcony TV out there, and will they be acquired, and who'll acquire them?
Yeah.
Well, I have not heard about the acquisition, but doesn't mean I won't comment on it anyway. I think it's probably a great thing because The Orchard is moving into other areas, away from just music, but into as well film and video and all of that. So if all of a sudden they can obtain the content creators and become, more integrated, I think it's a good move for The Orchard. They got a bunch of great folks over there.
Yeah, I missed the name of the company because of the
Balcony TV.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
I'm not familiar with Balcony TV.
Balcony TV, they shoot videos of bands on balconies, but they have about 40 cities.
That's the name, Balcony
40
TV.
Or 50 cities where they record these videos, and it's been going on for a few years, actually, I think.
Five, six years,
yeah, exactly. Hmm. So, it's an interesting acquisition, just as a network of people that are able to shoot bands wherever they end up being, I guess.
Interesting.
I'm sure
that they're probably finding, the whole video content ID and curating that kind of content is becoming huge, and so to me, if something like that's working and you're getting value off of, you know, monetizing on YouTube, I'm sure that it's got a good future.
Yeah, awesome. Well, Jim, I know I have to let you go, but I'm just going to finish up with these guys. And thanks so much for your time. Well, thanks, guys, so much for joining me today on the podcast. And Kevin, anything you want to plug? You've got a great podcast as well, so make sure you let people know about that.
Yeah, I mean, at CD Baby, we have the blog is more active, the DIY Musician blog, which has got lots of great content. The podcast that I do, the DIY Musician podcast, has some amazing interviews with artists and other industry people, and it's been on a little bit of a hiatus just because it's been a challenge to keep up with it. But but there's 130 episodes of content that is that I go back still and listen to with people, anyone from like Jack Conte from. Pamplemousse,
yeah.
To people like Seth Godin and stuff. Just lots of great advice to artists. So it's worth checking out. It's awesome. In the iTunes store
and all the blog is on cdbaby.com.
Yeah, it's if you search the CD Baby blog, you'll find it. So
okay, perfect. And Brian, of course, SF Music Tech coming up. When is it happening?
We got the SF Music Tech Summit. It's coming up on May 20th in San Francisco, sfmusictech.com. I hope you come on by. I also want to plug a bunch of the companies I'm involved in. This is Boombotics, wireless portable speaker. Two ways. You can do speakerphone. You can do Siri. They're really pretty indestructible.
Oh, no. It did break apart.
I can put the front back on. No problem. But, so all sorts of fun stuff. Less than three. Great player. Check them on out. There's all sorts of great stuff.
That's
Hope
awesome.
To see you in San Francisco in May.
Well, guys, thanks so much. And thanks for listening to the DMT podcast. We're going to have a couple of interviews after this with Spotify, OpenAura, and maybe a couple of others if I get the time to edit them and put them on. So stay tuned for more coverage of South by Southwest on sxsw.digitalmusictrends.com or also check out the show and all the videos on YouTube. Thanks so much for listening. Have a fantastic week, and until next time. This is a Digital Music Trends coverage of South by Southwest 2014, and I'm here with Sachin Doshi from Spotify. So hi, Sachin, thanks for joining me. How's it going?
Hi, nice to meet you.
And Sachin is Spotify's head of development and analysis, and we're just here in front of the Spotify house. We can see that there's a crazy line here. So
yeah, it's going great this year.
Absolutely. And so, you know, first of all, I want to talk about Spotify's audience. You recently announced the opening up of the platform for free to mobile users in a sort of limited way. And also giving a comparable experience as desktop for tablet users as well. So how has that affected the audience that you have? Have you seen a spike in usage, and then how has that worked?
Yeah, so we've been noticing for a long time before we launched the product that consumers, music listeners, had been abandoning their desktop. They were joining Spotify or downloading Spotify directly on their mobile or their tablet, never using their desktop to listen to music as the smartphone penetration's gotten much greater. And we realized that for our freemium model to continue to effectively grow the paid subscriber base, we needed to have some kind of free mobile option.
Yeah.
But of course, at the same time, maintaining some amount of functionality for premium users only. So we released the product in December that was a limited, as you say, somewhat limited free mobile product on smartphones, and bringing our desktop free on-demand product to tablets. And what's happened basically is we have seen more and more users stay and continue to use the service, where before, the moment they were asked to put their credit card in, they left, or most of them left, some of them would subscribe. What we're seeing now is we're retaining many more of those users. They continue to use the service, and then over time they will convert to our paid tier, whereas before we just lose them altogether.
That's great. And talking about conversion to the paid tier, so we're seeing an increasing number of amazing apps that are integrating the Spotify API out there.
Yep.
And of course, those are limited at the moment to the premium subscribers. So do you see that as a real driver for premium subscriptions for the company?
Yeah, I mean, I think as that ecosystem continues to grow, we expect that it will help us continue to convert users to paying. And honestly, we want to make sure that people who are willing to pay £10, €10, $10 a month are able to listen to music everywhere that they might interact or experience music.
Sure, absolutely. And looking at the back-end side of things, we just released a beta of the mobile SDK for iOS.
Yep.
So that's going to make it easier than ever for third-party developers to integrate Spotify within their own apps.
Yes.
So,
you
know, what kind of usage are you thinking of here?
It could be anything, honestly. It's anywhere that you would kind of experience music, whether that's just listening, having some type of interactions. It could be there's a history of music app, or We just released, or a company just released an app called Pacemaker, which is a DJ app, which allows you to basically use Spotify streams as the source for your DJ performances. I mean, there's a lot of different ways that you can imagine integrating music into an app, and we want to support all of it.
Yeah, sure. And looking at the ecosystem, of course, you started out in the app space with your own apps on the Dasco client. Yep. So how are you planning to move that forward?
It's unclear. I mean, that's been very successful for us, especially for our power users who really engage with those apps quite a bit. We have to, you know, we're continuing to evolve that platform so that it's better integrated into the overall Spotify experience.
Sure.
And as you said, build better tools for people to integrate Spotify into their own apps and their own sites.
Yeah, absolutely. And looking at the latest news of this week, of course, the acquisition of the Iconest was a really big deal because I've known those guys for forever. And, you know, it's a great acquisition. So from your front, the analytics and development front, what is exciting you about this?
You know, we've been working with the Iconest for a long time as well. Yeah. I think, you know, for years we've recognized the great work that they've done in machine listening and in understanding trends on the web and really developing probably the strongest data set around how people were consuming music outside of an actual digital streaming service or a download service. We think they're a natural fit for Spotify in helping us improve and continue to get better at music discovery on Spotify.
Yeah, absolutely. And we talked a lot about, you know, apps that are using the Spotify API, but Spotify also uses APIs from other companies to improve your service. For example, SoundKick is now fairly well integrated within the desktop client, and you have a lot of concert recommendations for gigs happening nearby of artists that you're following. Also, you had an interesting partnership with Next Big Sound for the artists, data that finally artists can get a better look at who's listening to what, where. Yep. Through Spotify. So how are you seeing those partnerships evolve and what kind of benefits are they bringing to the company?
I mean, SoundKick started really at first as an app partner on our desktop app. What we've done with both ticketing and merchandise with Topspin and with other partners is to allow users to very easily purchase tickets and merchandise from an artist on the service. And the idea here is that we want to provide as many tools as possible for artists to engage their fans on Spotify, and we're evolving that over time. Next Big Sound was a somewhat different partnership. That was really to give artists an understanding of how their content was being used on Spotify, what kind of streaming volume they were seeing, what kind of demographics were listening to their audience. And the idea is to then, for them to be able to use that dashboard to better understand their business, how Spotify is affecting their business, and also using Spotify as a better promotional tool, using the data to decide, you know, what kind of activities they might want to partake in, whether that's tour planning or, you know, whether appearing on a late night talk show helps them spike streams, all of these different things that the Next Big Sound dashboard allows artists to see. We wanted to make sure that they could see Spotify's impact on their business through that.
Yeah, sure. Looking at the international landscape, you know, Spotify is expanding into more and more countries all the time.
Yep.
So, how are you finding providing a great local catalog and support for that analysis and sort of all the right tools for local people to understand and find the localized content as well?
Yeah, so we are, only over the last year have we really stretched outside of our sort of Western Europe, United States initial launch territories. And what we're finding is that we're much more successful, obviously, when we spend the time to localize playlists, you know, help users, especially at the beginning. Ultimately, what we do all the time is to use the listening data to then power the discovery and to power what we surface to our users. So very quickly after we launch, we're able to use our initial users listening to help new users discover new music. At the beginning, we're just doing more work kind of manually curating playlists. We have a browse feature. I don't know if you've seen it, but our browse feature is one in which Spotify programs fantastic playlists, and we've been localizing all of those playlists so that when we launch in a country in Asia or in South America, you'll see heavily localized content in those playlists. And our radio stations are more heavily localized. So everything so that when, especially for those first few months when users go into the service, immediately they know that that service is for them, not just for Europe and the US.
That's awesome, actually. You know, the last thing I was gonna end on was, it's been written in a few places that, you know, the fact that you acquired the Iconest is a reinforcement of the fact that you're more attached to the data side than into the personal side of things. But, you know, the playlists are a really key factor for Spotify as well.
Yeah, we've always, look, the data is an extremely important resource for us to be able to plan and to understand various parts of a business, whether that's product features or how people are listening to music. But ultimately, especially in terms of how people connect with music, you have to be able to match that with some human element. We've never said otherwise. And, you know, we launched, we acquired Tunigo last year and then integrated them into our browse feature so that we did have that option. And we did have that feature for our users to be able to find curated playlists. And the other thing is that Spotify has always been a platform for our users to power that as well. So any user can become a tastemaker on the service and become, you know, we have a follow platform so that, and you know, if I wanted to go on and discover new music, I could follow tastemakers on the service. That could be you, that could be a celebrity, it could be anybody. And we just use the power of our own user base to be able to manually and human curation of music.
That's fantastic. And finally, what artists are you most excited about seeing at Spotify House this week?
Well, we just saw Jungle, who are fantastic.
Awesome.
Phanogram played yesterday. They're great. St. Paul and the Broken Bones, for those of you who don't know, great retro soul act. It's a great lineup all week, and we're really looking forward to enjoying the rest of it.
That's great. Well, Sachin, thanks so much for your time.
Absolutely. Thank you.
And thanks for listening to the DMT coverage of South by Southwest. It's all on digitalmusictrends.com, so go and find it there.
Hello everyone and welcome to Digital Music Trends coverage of South by Southwest 2014, and I'm here with Kevin Arnold, founder and CEO of Open Aura. So hi Kevin, and thanks for joining me. How's it going?
Great, thanks. Yeah, it's fun to be back in Austin.
Yeah, absolutely. And so Open Aura is a new project that you have. So first of all, tell us all about it. What is it?
Essentially, Open is a platform that aggregates and syndicates or distributes content centered around artist identity. Essentially, anything in digital form that represents who the artist is, trying to really focus on moving beyond the traditional, what we consider to be the 1980s version of artist identity, the bio and photo, into a much broader and full comprehensive set of any information created by or about the artist. So essentially, the artist is allowed to then curate and manage all of this content, publish it out to the places where its fans are engaging with them, and during the process, make money from it.
Yeah, and sure, and for people that don't know you, your background is at IOTA, of course. And so did that inform the start of this company, and how did you get the idea for it?
Yeah, it's interesting that I came to understand it eventually, actually just maybe a few months ago, how really similar it was to IOTA in a sense. And I've only just begun to speak about it as an aggregation platform. But yeah, it did come out of IOTA, I think, in a sense, post the merger with The Orchard in spring of 2012. I spent a year working with Sony Music on essentially some very high-level problems around that the industry is facing. Essentially, what can we do to create more engaging fan experiences around music online to sort of evolve the music user experience and a goal of increasing subscriptions and more fan engagement online. And it came out of that work and eventually was spun out into a new company. But it wasn't until after we started thinking about it, it was really, okay, it's an artist identity platform, or it's a platform for creating new types of fan experiences. Aggregation wasn't the original goal, but it turns out that was the secret to us to be able to start building out the platform and bring all the content to life.
So the way in which it's going to work, it's got a big focus on APIs as well,
yes.
The company. So how did that come about, and how are you planning to integrate that in order to make money for the artists that are on the platform?
Yeah, well, fundamentally, our product is APIs that publish indexes or information pointers to content that the artist has curated that they feel best represents them.
Yeah.
So it is really fundamental from a technology standpoint. We do a few different things. One is go out and try and identify and analyze all of the content that exists about an artist in open and social context. But a large part of the platform is also bringing what the artist owns and creates into the platform, as well as what anybody else has created about the artist, so that essentially you've got the full set of content at the artist's disposal to communicate better with the fan.
Yeah, sure. And so tell me about the process. So an artist wants to join Open Aura. How does it work? How do they get into it?
You know, so it's essential. It's as easy as going to our website, which is openor.com, and you'll see a big search box right at the top there. What we want an artist to do is come in and search for themselves and discover what we've already done for them, which is create what we call the default digital aura for the artist. So we've already gone out and hopefully identified all of an artist's social accounts, all of the open sources like Wikipedia, where information is.
Yeah.
And then we harvest and analyze all of that to create it, what we call a default aura. And then the artist comes in, claims their aura, logs in via Twitter or Facebook. And at that point, we are trusting that if you can log into their social accounts, that you are the artist. And then the artist is in control.
Yeah, sure. And from a legal perspective, branding is a very interesting thing, and it's different from country to country. I know that lawyers in the UK may recommend different things to lawyers in the US when it comes,
sure,
to actually acquiring the ownership of your brand as a band or as an artist. So in that sense, I guess Open Aura may really come in handy to establishing yourself as your own brand out there and be able to make a case for that as well.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, in a sense, I think that and most artists do spend a lot of time curating and cultivating their brand. The interesting thing about it is that it happens in a very fragmented and sort of chaotic way. There's content of different types, video, songs, information, images, and they're spread and published in many different places around the world. So while we think of this identity as a real sort of descriptive and fundamental part of who an artist is, it's actually quite spread out and fragmented around the world. One of the things that we do in getting started is just to come out and try and really understand, after 10 or 20 years of internet and social content creation, who is this person as defined by all of this information about them.
Yeah.
And once you have that look and understand, if you can go and, you know, any user can search for and browse any artist in the system,
yeah,
it's quite a different look of the artist, one that we feel actually is much more representative of who they truly are and what they're really doing. You know, this content that they're creating and interacting with every day is a much more intimate view of the artist, we feel, than the formal bio and photo. While,
yeah,
still important, there's a lot more out there that contributes to this identity.
Yeah. And so have you got any partnerships already in place? Or otherwise, what would be your ideal partner for this venture?
Yeah, so we look, as far as customers or partners for the API, it's really anybody who's creating an application or an experience around music or an artist. Essentially, we say any screen between an artist and a fan, which of course starts with music players and DSPs and digital music stores, but also ticketing websites, blogs, merchandising, any place, magazines online,
yeah,
that you might read about or experience an artist's content. So we think very broadly in that sense.
Yeah.
First customers for us, we're talking to dozens of companies out there, and we're about to just launch the public beta of our API.
Great.
And we aren't quite ready to talk about it, but
sure,
by the time the people might be seeing this, there should be some news about our first partners.
That's great. That's fantastic.
Yeah.
And so, what do you think about South by Southwest this year? And are you looking for partners here? And what is the general vibe for you?
Yeah, it's exciting this year, and it's fun for me coming back after having been here for more than a decade, I think, over the course of IOTA and other endeavors. It's great to be back with something new and
with a new set of eyes, right?
Being too busy, yeah, it is, and you sort of see everything through a different lens. Our focus here is yes, with music services and other customer potentials, but also a lot of conversations with artist managers and labels, right? So the platform is really meant to, it's been built from within the industry and
yeah,
in partnership with the industry. We obviously came from the label world, and in my past, many, much experience and relationships with the independent label landscape, a super important part of the equation. But also artist management are really at the core here. It's the artist that itself, has the right inherently to curate this identity and bring it to bear. And so it's a great new landscape for me, meeting a lot of the great artist managers out there. I mean, I had a pretty good set of contacts and relationships, but it's a broad new world. So yeah, we've got very full schedules as we try and
yeah,
meet with as many people as we can to spread the word.
And it's a good time to move into this space as well, with this new angle as well. We're seeing acquisitions like that of the Econest last week. So
yeah, it's been a very exciting couple of weeks,
yeah,
or week, I guess, for the space. And, we're We're brand new, just entering. Primarily, core for us at South By this year is the music hackathon that they're hosting the first one of, and it's also the debut of our public beta API. And we've been building this platform for a long time, and just very excited to get it into the hands of developers, alongside some other great companies that will be participating, like Echo Nest and Gracenote and Spotify and others, and see what people can build. Because
that's great. So you're part of the hackathon.
Yes. Yeah. Awesome. Yeah. From that standpoint, the API is unique in that there aren't any open APIs that offer authentic artist information and content that the artist really wants you to see, along with all of this other social and information that's been posted about them. So we're really excited to see what people will build.
That's fantastic. And so can you give us a website for developers or people that are interested in the product?
Yes, yeah. The website's www.openora.com, and the developer site will be up and available at developers.openora.com starting Wednesday, I believe.
Okay, perfect. Well, thank you so much for your time.
Yeah, cheers. Thanks.
And thanks for listening to the DMT coverage of South by Southwest. You can find out everything on digitalmusictrends.com.